Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Issa Arsene about her debut novel, Shoot the Moon. Although in some ways 1969 barely seems long enough ago to qualify as historical fiction, The Moonwalk already lies far in the past for many of my listeners. And when it comes to details of daily life, the roles of men and women, the prevalence of cigarettes, and many other things, large and small, we really are living in a different world. That is immediately obvious from the beginning of Arsene's engrossing fictional dive into NASA culture circa the mid-1960s. 1966, the Manned Spacecraft Center, Dr. Alan Gibbs's empty office, Houston, Texas. I blew a piston of smoke through the open window and took another draw on its heels, my eyes fixed on the waxing moon hanging high above. The sill dug softly into my elbows as I drank the fresh air. I was lucky the door had been unlocked, and luckier still the random room I'd chosen had a window. Beyond the door I'd shut tight behind me, the office-wide Christmas party carried on with a crush of seasonal noise and bluster I hadn't been doused in since I was a kid. My parents were the only ones of their friends who had gone and had a child amid the heaving groundswell of the 1940s. Having a daughter bouncing around like a free agent didn't deter mother from throwing her Christmas party in excess every year. With the other lab men and their wives on leave from Los Alamos for only a precious handful of days, for one night a year our house was a tiny nucleus of normalcy, warmed to bursting by laughter, spiced wine, and the popping of paper crackers I had helped make at the kitchen table the week prior. And now, please join me in welcoming Issa Arsene. Hi, Issa. I look forward to talking with you today.
Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
As I mentioned, Shoot the Moon is your debut novel. How did you get started writing fiction?
I have been writing for as long as I could hold a pencil. I loved reading when I was a kid, and then when I realized I could make up my own stories, I just started and never stopped. I have stacks of old notebooks of just me riffing on ideas that came up from when I read my favorite books. It's very, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery, aka I was just sort of playing with characters that other people already made up and learning how to tell my own stories with that. And it has just always been something that I've kept running alongside my own daily life. There has never been a reality for me in which I was not writing. But I started taking it seriously a couple years ago, the early months of the pandemic, which sounds trite to say, but truly it's, you know, you have all the time in the world and you have this huge global crisis that you don't really know how to deal with. But, the one thing that I could control was telling myself, well, I think I can finish a manuscript now. So Shoot the Moon was not the first full manuscript that I finished, but it was the first one that I really thought had legs and could hold water and could become a fully fledged book. And now here it is. But yeah, it's kind of an underwhelming answer to the question, but I have just always been writing. But no, I don't have a formal education in it. It has just always been a piece of me.
I don't have a formal education in it either. I did it just for fun as well. So.
Yeah, it is a really special way to come to it. I think it's the crop of us who are just drawn to it by our nature. I think we do have an interesting slice of the creative pie with that.
I agree. So we meet your main character, Annie Fisk, when she's in her mid-20s. What should we know about her at this point in her life?
By the time Annie is in her 20s, she has experienced a lot. She has experienced loss and love in equal measure. But at that stage in particular, she is really deciding what she wants for herself from the world. And she's not somebody who's very good at being told, no, you can't, or rather, she doesn't really understand limits. She's not somebody who was raised to be okay with walls being in her way, whether it's explicit or not, the way that her father is a scientist, and I think we'll talk about that later, but she has just always been around progress in science and curiosity in the world around us and kind of what makes reality tick. So she is really stepping into her own of making her father's ideas of what mankind is and what we take from the world and forming her own opinions about that. So it's equal parts kind of confused and figuring things out as she goes, but also having this very strong conviction on the inside of her that says, I'm drawn to this thing and I don't really know why, but I'm going to chase it down.
The novel shifts back and forth between Annie's present and her past. There's a good reason for this, and we're not going to reveal what it is because we need to tread carefully to avoid spoilers. But the first place that we go is from 1966 to 1948, when Annie is about 8 years old. What is her life like at that moment?
In 1948, sort of the 40s and these early 50s, Annie is a very precocious child. She doesn't know that the world can be anything but exciting and amazing and beautiful. And she is very much in that innocence phase of childhood, which I think is a very special period of time that it lasts different lengths for different people. But it was really special to be able to dive into that and figure, I know where I want this woman's life to go, but how did it start? But it's quite idyllic. It's very quiet. She's the only child with her parents, which was unique in the 40s. She makes her own fun. She comes up with a whole bunch of ways to not feel so lonely. And she's just very capable at sort of filling her own space at that stage.
Her father is a scientist at Los Alamos. It's a coincidence, of course, that your book is coming out a few months after Oppenheimer became a box office draw. But it's a nice coincidence for you. What can you tell us about Annie's daddy and what makes him, in her words, sad?
I have always been drawn to the human element of any sort of scientific progress, whether it is weapons development or exploration. I think that the fact that we are humans making things that can either make discoveries or cause great harm to others, I think it's, and oftentimes those two are holding the same thing in the same set of hands. But the way that I have wrapped my mind around Annie's father, Ford, is that he is somebody who, very similar to his daughter, I think has come up through these halls of science and really driving towards progress and seeing, you know, he has this great mind and he wants to use it to the best of his ability and feel sated in this need to discover and feel relevant, really. So it's a little bit of ego, it's a little bit of nature at once. And I think for him, the main crux of the issue is that he feels fulfilled by the work that he's doing, but he does understand that it comes at a great price where you do. And I think Oppenheimer, the Nolan film, did a very good job of presenting this duality of, you know, yes, you are this incredible genius and you are contributing to this team of people who are truly breaking ground, but at the same time, you are building something that is so deeply destructive and is so intensely strange on the scale of what can we, what is possible. I think quantum physics is a hell of a thing. So there has to be some element of personal reckoning that comes into that to each scientist, I think, with different degrees. And obviously I'm not a scientist myself, but it was a very interesting study of a character to turn over the idea of what would that be like? What is that process? What is that emotional position that you're put in with progress versus responsibility?
Even though her father is a difficult character in some ways, Annie's relationship with him seems to be more affectionate than her bond with her mother. How would you describe Helen as a personality? What did she want from life, and did she attain it?
I think Helen is a peacemaker. She's somebody who wants to feel needed and loved and necessary in the equation. She very deeply wants to be a mother. She loves her daughter. She loves her husband. She was probably raised very traditionally. Being a young woman, it would have been in the 20s and 30s. But some of her, the backstory that I have spun up for her and Ford is that they did meet when he was in kind of the earlier stages of university. So they met one another at a time where almost an innocence of excitement of what's coming down the pipe was very fresh for both of them. I think it was the interwar between World War I and World War II. So Helen is somebody who I think expresses her love best by directing and sort of putting a plan in action, which is great because I think Ford is a man who's very scattered. He's very married to his work. He's got a pretty limited view on the present, where the only thing that exists is the thing that's right in front of his nose. But he's married to a woman who is able to see the bigger picture. And I think that is something that endears her to Annie in a way that Annie doesn't really understand until later in her life, is that her mother really does see more than she lets on. And her mother does understand her in a way that she isn't able to parse until much later.
I have the impression, too, that it must have been quite difficult for wives at Los Alamos because of the secrecy and the isolation.
I think so. Yes, there's a lot of books and a lot of material, particularly the museum in New Mexico, that focuses on the fact that, you know, socially you have these people who were raised and built up to be homemakers and keep the peace and make your family happy and sort of distract them almost. It was very much that you have these families and these children that are supposed to not really be aware of the real truth of what's going on. So I do think that they had a very tall order on their shoulders to take a lot of the burden, where it's, you know, your husband needs to be primed and ready to work. So you sort of have to take a lot of the emotional labor out of the process. And I think there's a lot more complex emotions at work in that time, in that location, than I think we're really able to even parse from here. But yeah, it is ripe for, I want to see somebody else do a book that is specifically about the family units there. So I am eagerly awaiting that on my bookshelf someday.
And I can imagine, I mean, in the 50s too, it was even more now than now, it was a woman's job, a wife's job, to handle the emotions, where, especially with a scientist and a physicist of all people, I mean, those are, I don't want to make horrible generalizations, but I do get the sense that people who are drawn to physics are very much interested in the, I don't know how exactly to express it, but the sort of practical things in life, even though their field is, you know, theoretical physics is almost mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, too, to build those relationships, because in many ways, Annie is the perfect blend of both of her parents. She is sort of this gentler spirit that is very similar to her mother, and she does want things to be a very certain way. She wants to be in control of things, but at the same time, she can't help but be drawn into this world of exploration and physics and impossibility. And she doesn't quite know how to reckon it, but it was very rewarding for me to sort of build in the subtleties of her relationships with her parents.
Annie, as a child, has a favorite spot at the back of her yard. What makes it special to her?
Annie, I think, is somebody who is okay with not having a lot. I think she tends to kind of make her own fun, particularly as a kid. She's an only child in an era where families were large. It was rare that a family only had one kid. So I think deep down, she wants for a sibling. She wants for somebody her age to resonate with. She doesn't want to be lonely. She doesn't understand that she's lonely, but it's a feeling that she has as a kid. She can't point to it objectively and say, this is what I feel. But the spot in the backyard gives her something that is hers. It gives her something that she doesn't have to explain to anybody. It's okay that she's alone when she's out there, because it captivates her interest. And in the second chapter of the book, so I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she has an imaginary friend too that shows up there. So it's very much the idea of a child filling in the spaces that they don't understand that something is missing there, but they fill it anyways because it's natural for them to kind of, I like to think that the default for children is happiness, and they'll sort of bend reality in any way to make that happiness for themselves, even if they don't kind of know why they are unhappy. So it was the spot in the garden is just as much a symbol as I think a very literal element of the story at once.
At 18, Annie leaves home and heads for Texas, where she enrolls in college. What's that experience like for her?
It's the first moment where she really realizes that she is an adult and she is driving her own destiny. for much of her childhood, for all of her young adult life, she has hinged her ambitions and her purpose on, you know, what would my father do? What would be expected of me? And now she's thrown into this collegiate atmosphere, and all of a sudden she gets to take her own classes, she gets to chase her own dreams and wants, and she gets to make friends that turn into more than just friends. So it is a truly an awakening, I think, in every sense of the word for her. And she doesn't understand the magnitude of that immediately, but it gets there.
She majors in physics and astronomy. Obviously, part of the appeal there is that her father is a physicist. But what draws her to those particular fields? Because they're quite unusual fields for a young woman to enter into in the early 50s.
Yeah, the physics element is definitely her projecting onto her father to say, you know, I am my father's daughter. This is what he did. This is what I must do as well. And the astronomy element of it does come from the connection that she forges with her father. There is a chapter where he explicitly tells her, you know, she says to him, I want to do what you do when you grow up. And he tells her, well, I don't want you to do what I do. How about you work on something made for exploration? How about you figure out how to go to the moon? So she internalizes that and really makes that her mission to fulfill the promise that she made to him. And the best way that she can think to do that is quite literally studying planets and physics at once. And she finds a professor in the astronomy department who really has her best interest at heart. And that was a really fun relationship to build between her and Professor Leight. I think anybody who has done college in any capacity, I would hope that everybody has the opportunity to have a connection with a professor that really gets them and moves them and inspires them. And it's a very unique relationship that I think is very, it's a very special, very innocent, very pure connection to have between two people. So it was really fun to put that together on the page.
Annie also has her first serious romantic relationship, at least that was my impression, in college with a woman named Evelyn. What brings them together?
I think Evelyn is everything that Annie sees and admires, but doesn't feel that she can become. And Annie is somebody that Evelyn is just completely enamored by because Annie doesn't play by anybody else's rules. And the reason it's so organic to Annie is that she doesn't think that there's any other way to do things. She's a very literal person. She's very, it's almost dry, where she's analytical, she's numbers-minded, and nothing else matters besides the truth. And Evelyn is somebody who's a lot more emotional, a lot more artistic. She's a painter. So they really are two sides of the same coin, and, you know, opposites attract. And I do think that initially, for Evelyn at least, it's the challenge of kind of cracking the egg on this woman who is such an enigma to her. She doesn't understand Annie. And Annie is just completely enamored by Evelyn. She has moved through her teenage years understanding that she is attracted to women in some capacity, but not really knowing what to do with that. And Evelyn is the first time that somebody objectively looks at her and says, you know, hello, I am attracted to you and I would like to pursue this.
Nonetheless, Annie's heart is set on NASA. How does she get to that opening scene in 1966?
Well, Annie points herself towards NASA without really knowing why. There is an element in the book that kind of seeds the path to this. But she is told by that same professor, Dr. Leight, that the best way to get work is to get your foot in the door. But he encourages her, you know, once you get your foot in, just keep walking. Don't settle for something that kind of cuts your curiosity off at the pass. So I think it really is just her ambition that gets her all the way from college to NASA. She works a couple odd jobs in the meantime, but she's a very driven person, and it is very much her personal mission to accomplish what she feels on a very chemical, cellular level that is something that belongs to her that she just has to do.
What can you tell us about Norman Gale, the man that she encounters later in that opening scene?
Norman, I think, is like every heartthrob mixed with like dorky, lovely, sweet man that I could think to mash together. I love him. I am biased. He's one of my favorite characters that I've ever put together. He really loves that Annie is smart. He likes the idea of a woman being able to put him in his place. He likes the idea of suddenly not being the smartest person in the room, double bonus points because it's a woman and it's a pretty woman. It's a woman that he's attracted to. He's somebody who is, he knows what he wants just as much as Annie knows what she wants. And he is very dogged in the pursuit of that. But I think similarly to Evelyn, he's somebody who does let his heart drive a little bit. He's not entirely head directed, which again plays into the relationship dynamic that he forges with Annie, where she is very much the head. He is much more the heart. She tends to attach herself to people who can, and I think it's an unwitting choice that she makes, is that she attaches herself to people who make up for the characteristics that she lacks. Annie is somebody I think that has quite good instincts when it comes to falling in love with people, and it's entirely unintentional on her part, but she follows and it gravitates towards people who want to take care of her.
Yeah, he really is a charmer. I was very taken with him too.
He's so much fun. I love him. I love Norm.
He wanted to be an astronaut. What got in his way?
He wanted to fly, become a pilot. The backstory that he has is a large military family. His brothers are pilots. He's the youngest brother. But he has a number of physical limitations that kept him out of the cockpit. He was not allowed to become a pilot. So the next best thing was studying up on engineering and becoming a navigator. So he can pilot from the ground. I think at one point he says, the reason that he does any of this is so he can see the stars from where he is able to be.
So despite her degree and her stellar grades and everything else, Annie begins at NASA as a secretary, which is very indicative of the way educated women were treated at the time. Even when I got out of college, you were asked how many words you could type per minute. And she accepts that position knowingly to get her foot in the door, but she doesn't stay as secretary. So how does she end up in computer programming?
She ends up on the programming team partially by Norm's meddling and partially by her willingness to step up to the plate and give it a go. You'll see at some point Norm manages to convince her to come to dinner with him and very ungracefully lets on that he went to his superior and told him that, hey, Fisk is a little too smart to be a secretary, which is its own brand of like accidental misogyny of the time. But she accepts the test to take to make sure that she has the know-how to be one of the programmers. she takes the bull by the horns and accepts the position. And from there, then things really start taking off. So yeah, she is fearless when she knows that it's something that she wants.
So what I loved about this novel is that even though it's set during the planning stages for the Apollo spacecraft, it is about NASA and it's about the Apollo program, but it's mostly, I think, about Annie's personal development. And about halfway through, it takes a surprising turn, which I'm not going to reveal. So I'm going to ask you as a writing question, how did you come up with this way of approaching the story? What made it best suited to this story?
It has been kind of a non-linear back and forth, scenes from the past mixing with scenes from the present from the very earliest stages of the outline of the first crack that I took at the idea. I kind of raised myself literally on a diet of postmodern kind of weird novels that like to play with form and kind of buck the conventional idea of what story, what linear storytelling can be. I like the idea of pulling a reader into the car and saying, we're driving from point A to point B. Here it is on the map, but I'm not going to tell you how we're going to get there. And it's a fun exercise in trust to expect the reader to say, yep, take me where you're going to take me. And, I have done that countless times with books that I have ended up loving from a reader's perspective. So it was kind of a personal test of muster for me to say, can I make this work? And kudos to my editor, Kate Dresser. She was able to We played a lot of Jenga with the order of the scenes, and there's a couple different scenes that are quite pivotal, heavy moments that ended up in 2, 3, 4 different places throughout the editorial process. But finally, once we landed on the order that they ended up in, we knew that that was the one. So yeah, it for me, the idea of character development parallels throughout a life, you know, you do think to childhood and young adulthood and adulthood, and we are all of us series of patterns, and sometimes we repeat behaviors, sometimes we pick up new behaviors, but I think all of us are informed by who we have been and who we are currently growing into, and perhaps who we will be if we have some eye to what we want to do in the future, and you know, where we would like to grow. But this idea of no matter what point in time you're looking at in somebody's life, there are moments of parallel, and finding those spaces, the way that the chapters move, my hope is that it never feels disjointed because there's always a through line of the character driving in the same direction. I tried very hard not to jump too hard between Annie being person A and Annie being person B next to each other. I really wanted that growth to be clear from childhood all the way up into adulthood, regardless of the period of time that it was.
No, I thought it really worked. I thought it was amazingly
well done.
I was impressed. I was like, my God, how did she pull that off? But you did.
Thank you so much. Yeah, there were a lot of kind of nights where I was kind of tugging at the loose of my hair, being like, my God, what did I get myself into? But we made it work. So it's very rewarding to see it now all laid out on the page and say, like, yes, that is a cohesive story that we have.
So are there characters or incidents I haven't mentioned that you would like listeners to hear about?
There's one character who comes up about 2/3 of the way through the book, Art McCabe. He's one of the flight directors at NASA, and he's grumpy and, you know, stressed. They're in the last couple months of Apollo 11. They're approaching the launch. Things are going wrong. But at his heart, he's a very warm, tender person, and he's like mad about the fact that he is so soft and tender. So he was a lot of fun to put together, and he and Annie have a great rapport between them. Art McCabe, I think, is like in the running for my favorite character in this.
And actually, as you mentioned him, there's one other, and I'm blocking on her name, but the woman who is in charge of the computer programming was a really interesting
Roz.
Character. Roz, yes.
Washington.
Tell us about her.
She's great. She's a genius. She's very intimidating. She is a woman of color in the 1960s, so she has a lot of, you know, moxie and toughness that shouldn't have to belong to her, but, you know, she's had to have worked twice as hard to get to the same place that other people, white women, would have only had to work one time as hard to get to. If you've seen read Margalit Cheddar's book or the movie that came after it, Hidden Figures, that focuses beautifully on the fact that the programmers at NASA were largely women of color. Computer programming was seen as drudge work back then. It was not kind of the shiny, sexy field that it is today, because back then people didn't realize that that was the meat of the work. They thought it was an auxiliary process. So they gave it to the lowest common denominator, which unfortunately in that time was women of color. So Roz, I personally am not Black, so I didn't feel comfortable making the story about Black women. And again, I think that has been done before in a way that it would have been stupid of me to try to outshine it. But it is important that I think attention is pointed to and drawn to the fact that we could not have gotten to the moon without Black women in America.
That's a very good point, yes. What would you like people to take away from Shoot the Moon?
I think ultimately the book is about hope. It's about understanding that the days can get dark and things can get bleak. And the reality that we live in is often very ugly. But ultimately, the thing that drives us and the thing that keeps us all together is the fact that we can love one another. And I think that if we can remember that and always find connection points between each other and understand that it's just as important for us to tell people that we love them as it is to do anything else. You know, you never know when you're not going to have another chance to tell somebody what they mean to you. So you might as well do it every single time you see them. So I do think that hope and the ability to tell the people that you care about how much you care about them is the only thing that matters, really, at the end of the day, is the fact that we love.
Are you already working on another novel?
I am, yes. I have just another novel with Putnam. It's coming out in, I think, early 2025. It's called The Unbecoming of Margaret Wolfe. And it's another mid-century story. It's about a woman who is a Shakespearean actress in New York in the 50s and her relationship with her co-actor, Wesley, and a summer festival that completely flies off the handle.
It sounds delightful. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today, Issa. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I had a great time. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.B. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Issa Arsene about Shoot the Moon. Find out more about her at inarsene.com. That's I-N-A-R-S-E-N. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at New Books Network. You can find out more about me and my books at cplesley.com, where I blog about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.